content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this issue is dated January 28th, 2011. And our first item on this program is entitled, The GOP's Effort to Dismantle Health Reform. What happened? The House of Representatives this week voted to repeal the sweeping health care reform signed into law by President Barack Obama last year, the first in a planned series of Republican efforts to undermine the legislation. The GOP's repeal bill was primarily symbolic because it will almost certainly die in the Democratic-controlled Senate. Republicans claim the health care reform law would burden businesses, destroy jobs, and increase the federal deficit. This new law is a fiscal house of cards, said GOP Representative Paul Ryan. Democrats responded by launching a new campaign to sell their reform plan to skeptical Americans. Their congressional leaders and President Obama warned that repeal would threaten more than 50 million Americans with pre-existing health conditions and leave 50 million people uninsured. We can't go backward, Obama said. Americans deserve the freedom and security of knowing that insurance companies can't deny, cap, or drop their coverage when they need it the most. Now here's what some of the editorials had to say about this issue. The cartoonish title of the GOP repeal bill, Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act, tells you all you need to know, said the Las Vegas Sun. It not only confirms Republicans' immaturity, it's also a flat-out lie. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says the reform law provides cost savings that will actually reduce the deficit by $230 billion over 10 years. And with 32 million uninsured Americans gaining insurance coverage under reform, tens of thousands of new health care jobs will be created. Repealing Obamacare is what Republicans who won in November were sent to Washington to do, said the New York Post. The CBO estimate of its cost savings is a fiction, created because Democrats ordered to make it a host of absurd assumptions. The law will greatly increase health care costs and premiums, impose new taxes on employers and citizens, and impose an unconstitutional mandate that everyone buy health insurance. To keep all that from happening, said National Review, Republicans should remove Obamacare's sources of funding, such as taxes on medical devices and tanning salons. Rather than allow the public to grow resigned to Obama's boondoggle, we must keep hope of repeal alive. Now here's what the columnist had to say. What happened to all the Republicans' violent rhetoric, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. It took the attempted assassination of a Democratic colleague to shame them. But Republicans this week finally proved capable of self-restraint. Talk of tyranny, baby killers, and death panels was gone. House Speaker John Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor even stopped using the phrase job-killing to attack the reform plan, substituting job-destroying. If only Democrats had exercised some restraint when constructing their fiscal time bomb, said Timothy Carney in the Washington Examiner, we need only to look at Mitt Romney's health care reform in Massachusetts, the inspiration for Obamacare, to see what lies ahead. In Massachusetts, a similar reliance on subsidies, mandates, and regulations quickly caused health insurance and health care costs to spike, requiring cost controls on insurers and providers while raising taxes on the state's residents and businesses. I wouldn't want to be a red state Democrat up for re-election in 2012, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. In coming months, they'll be forced to vote again and again on legislation highlighting reform's most unpopular elements, from the individual mandate to cuts to the Medicare Advantage program. Actually, it's Republicans who should worry, said Kirsten Powers in TheDailyBeast.com. the public's feverish fear of the new law has broken. A new Washington Post ABC News poll shows 37% of Americans favor repealing all or parts of the law, with just 18% favoring total repeal. Just wait until voters realize the GOP is trying to take away protections from lifetime and annual caps, denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions, and being dropped from your health insurance if you get sick. Congress is not debating two visions of fixing health care, said Ezra Klein in the WashingtonPost.com. Obama's reform plan offers expanded coverage, cost control experiments, and a more competitive insurance market. What do Republicans offer other than the dysfunctional and inhumane status quo? Our next item from the main story section from this week for The Week magazine is a revolution in Tunisia. Tunisians poured into the streets demanding democracy this week after becoming the first Arab people to overthrow a dictator in a popular uprising. President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who ruled the North African country for 23 years, fled after a month of demonstrations triggered by unemployment, reports of government corruption, and an unemployed university graduate's self-immolation. The political elite quickly formed a unity government, but the Jasmine Revolution, named after the state flower, may not be over. Protesters demand that members of Ben Ali's inner circle be banned from government. Riot police sprayed crowds with tear gas. The unrest threatened to spread to other Arab nations as a dozen protesters in Egypt and Algeria set themselves on fire. The Arab people have reached a boiling point, said Adla Massoud in HuffingtonPost.com. From North Africa to the Middle East, a staggering 25% of young people are unemployed. They want jobs, yet their despotic leaders wish only to cling to power. In Egypt, President Hosni Mubarak is entering his 30th year in office. In Libya, Muammar al-Qaddafi has been in power since 1969, while in Syria, the Assads have ruled since 1970. All are ripe for revolution. No Tunisia stands alone, said Joseph Joffe in The New Republic. With its relatively advanced economy and educated urbanized populace, Tunisia sticks out like a bloody thumb from the rest of the Arab world. History shows that rising wealth spells falling tyrants, and the average Tunisian is just rich enough and educated enough to revolt. Other Arab countries are either much poorer, like Morocco, Egypt, and Syria, or so rich, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that their citizens have no particular spur to demand democracy. So don't count on Tunisia to set the rest of the Arab world aflame. The Jasmine Revolution could still collapse, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. A new strongman could emerge, or Islamists could take over. The Obama administration can help fend this off by granting all possible assistance for the staging of free and fair elections. For too long, the U.S. supported Ben Ali as an ally in the war on terror. It should now aid Tunisia's nascent democracy. The next item, Giffords' condition improves. Representative Gabrielle Giffords continued her remarkable recovery this week as doctors detached her ventilator and let her sit up, and family members said she was moving her limbs and interacting with them without speaking. Every day, Gabby improves and shows higher levels of comprehension and complex actions, her mother said. Giffords' husband, NASA astronaut Captain Mark Kelly, said he was confident that Giffords recognizes him. The congresswoman who was shot in the head in the Tucson shooting spree that left 6 dead and 13 others injured reportedly rubbed her husband's neck and looked at get-well cards. Doctors said Giffords might be discharged to a rehabilitation facility within days. San Diego federal judge Larry Burns was assigned to preside at the trial of accused gunman Jared Loughner after Arizona judges recused themselves due to the murder of their colleague, federal judge John Roll. Recovering from the traumatic brain injury is never easy, said Ken Altucker in the Arizona Republic. It's unclear how much movement Giffords controls on her right side, which can be impaired when the left part of the brain is injured. Her doctors cannot predict how well she'll see or speak, or how much cognitive functioning she'll regain. She's a fighter, said Giffords' husband. Giffords no doubt has months of fighting still to go. Several Democratic members of Congress began promoting gun control measures following the shooting, said Jeffrey Miron in Bloomberg.com, but they have virtually no chance of passing. Banning large ammunition clips wouldn't deter a determined assailant like Loeffner, who could have bought several guns, allowing him to continue firing without interruption. In Arizona, the most likely legislative response is going to be expanded gun rights, said David Weigel in Slate.com. Republicans have a huge majority in the state legislature, and they're seeing looser gun laws as the answer, not the problem. And the controversy of the week is related to Tucson. The title is, After Tucson, Can America Be a More Civil Nation? The president is right, said the Philadelphia Inquirer in an editorial. It's time to cool it. At last week's memorial service for the victims of the Arizona shootings, President Barack Obama paid moving tribute to the 19 people killed and wounded, including U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords, and then issued a stirring call for Americans to put aside cynicism and vitriol and learn to question each other's ideas without questioning each other's love of country. Brilliantly, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, Obama managed to ask for more civility in public discourse without accusing anyone of incivility. Instead, he cited the memory of 9-year-old Christina Taylor Greene, born on September 11th, who was shot dead in Tucson as she waited to meet her congresswoman. With his voice cracking, Obama asked Americans to help make our democracy as good as Christina imagined it. Reforming our choleric and dysfunctional political culture won't be easy, but Obama's powerful speech, hailed by critics and supporters alike as the best of his presidency, made that goal no longer seem impossible. Make no mistake, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com, this was a political speech from start to finish. Calling for civility was easy enough for Obama after his surrogates in the liberal media had already done the dirty work of blaming conservative rhetoric for the Tucson massacre. But his flowery rhetoric was nothing more than an attempt to shame his critics into tempering all future criticism. That he used a little girl's death to do so was breathtakingly cynical. Of course, Obama wants more civility in public discourse, said Investor's Business Daily in an editorial. After two disastrous years in which he added trillions to the national debt and gave us a government-controlled health care system we don't want, people are understandably very angry with the president. He just doesn't want to hear it. The real goal of this speech was not a more civil public discourse, but the replacement of public discourse with public acquiescence. Not much danger of that, said Robert Robb in the Arizona Republic. America is a contentious, divided nation with a long and rich tradition of vilifying and demonizing political opponents. Anyone who thinks today's political atmosphere is rougher than it has been in the past needs to recall that our first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, was shot and killed in a duel with the sitting Vice President, Aaron Burr. Let's also not forget the civil rights debates of the 1950s, said John Sununu in the Boston Globe, or the rancor and riots of the Vietnam era. Still demonizing political opponents and questioning their motives poisons the well, with the result that less gets done. Whatever one's party, whatever one's goal, we all benefit from good manners in government. Good manners, though, begin with humility, said David Brooks in the New York Times, and humility in this era of bombast is in very short supply. The reason we're drowning in intellectual thuggery and partisan one-sidedness is that our culture encourages people to think highly of themselves and to believe that they and they alone possess direct access to the truth. The civility Obama made the case for so movingly in Tucson comes naturally to anyone with the wisdom to know that he might, on occasion, be wrong, and therefore needs to listen to other points of view. We are all fallible. We're all sometimes foolish. Instead of angrily insisting that our side is always right, how about a return to modesty? And now it's time to turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Well, it was a good week for eating your broccoli after British researchers found that eating 5 more portions of fruit and vegetables a day raises carotenoid levels and gives skin a golden tone, making people look healthier and more attractive. It was a good week for alternative fuel sources after a group of Austrian undertakers said they plan to funnel the excess heat generated by the crematorium next door in their new headquarters so as to not waste energy. And it was a good week for ridiculous get-ups after Forbes magazine projected that Lady Gaga would make $100 million in 2011. Now, it was a bad week for a fox hunter in Belarus who was shot in the leg by his wounded prey. The hunter approached the fox to finish it off with the butt of his rifle, authorities said, but in the ensuing struggle, the fox pulled the trigger with its paw and shot the hunter. It was a bad week for governating after former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger calculated that he lost $200 million in box office receipts by serving in government instead of making movies. It was more than worth it, Arnold added. And it was a bad week for brotherly love after Alabama Governor Robert Bentley said in his inaugural address that anybody here today who has not accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior, you're not my brother and you're not my sister. As an olive branch to non-Christians, Bentley added, I want to be your brother. And the rest was up to them. Now let's take a look at some items in the Week magazine this week about people in the news. The first series of articles is under the headline, It Wasn't All Bad. John Davis, a mechanic from Pawleys Island, South Carolina, was down to $6 in his checking account and was only days away from foreclosure when his luck turned. Davis won a $200,000 lottery jackpot. Winning took my breath away, said Davis, a single father of 2 daughters, aged 3 and 15. A few of the people at work came over and I said, am I seeing things? They said, no, you won the lottery. Davis said he will use the money to pay off his mortgage and save for his daughter's college tuition. Inez Harris and Venice Shaw, identical twins born January 15, 1911, celebrated their 100th birthday last week. The credit union of Lockheed Aircraft in Burbank, California, where Harry's worked during World War II, threw the twins a party. The odds of identical twins living to be 100 is 1 in 700 million, said the credit union's Andrea Carpenter. Harry's, who has 9 granddaughters, 19 great-grandchildren, and 3 great-great-grandchildren, said, I keep active, try to keep active. The minute you stop, you've had it. And 6th-grade teacher Deborah Court of the St. Paul Lutheran School in Bondueil, Wisconsin, was searching an old safe for baptism records to show her students when she came across an aged Bible. No one at the church realized just how old it was until the church pastor sent pictures of it to the Concordia Seminary Library in St. Louis, where a cataloger concluded it had been printed 340 years ago. To hold something that tells us in 1670, the same message of God's grace and Christ that we tell each other today, said Pastor Timothy Shoup, that helps me to be even more thankful. And under the general category of people in the Week magazine this week, a couple of more items. Acting out his confessions. Oliver Thomas is readying himself for the performance of his life, said Doug McCash in the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Thomas, a disgraced former New Orleans city councilman, is preparing to portray himself in a play called Reflections, A Man and His Time. 4 years ago, Thomas, who was 53 years old, was a rising star and possible mayoral candidate when he was charged with accepting a $20,000 bribe and sent to prison for 2.5 years. It was in prison that a director and writer approached him to star in a play about his own rise and fall. the gall of him, Thomas recalls thinking. I'm fresh in my sentence, and he wants me to think about putting the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me on stage. Eventually, Thomas, who has a background in community theater, bought into the idea of playing himself. Why would I be able to play everybody else's story and not lend the theater the story of my life? Owning up to his mistakes through the vehicle of drama has been cathartic. I've cried during rehearsal, he says. It's like going to therapy and admitting who you are to your therapist. Being a politician, he says, prepared him for acting. In the sad sense, politics is too much theater. Some of the acting in politics has been crafted by politicians so well that people believe it's not acting, when in too many cases it is acting. It's just a stage play at the highest level. And the final item from the People section this week, Williams' Life After Ledger. Michelle Williams is finally able to talk about Heath Ledger, said Leslie Bennett and Marie Claire. It's been 3 years since Ledger, her former fiancé and the father of her daughter, died of an accidental overdose of pills. My heart is broken, she said at the time, and then she shut off. Everyone has a tragedy. I met mine a little early, says the actress, who is 30 years old. How do I talk about this? I experienced a lot of loss after his death. I lost my city because of the paparazzi descending upon us. I actually lost my journal during that time. It felt as if things were slipping through my fingers. I lost my sense of humor. I'm still sort of looking for that. She had to keep functioning, though, because of the couple's daughter, Matilda, who is about to enter first grade. Recently, Williams began dating again, though she's proceeding with caution. Very obviously for me and for Matilda, there's a hole in our life, says Williams. Of course, the natural inclination is to want to fill it up. But what I've come to recently is that it's impossible. I'm not going to rush anything. For now, she's just happy she made it through. I kept it together. I didn't fall apart, said Michelle Williams. Now we'll turn to the weekly column in The Week magazine entitled The Briefing, and the title this week is The Anti-American. Embattled Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is cracking down on dissent and ramping up his hostility to the U.S. How popular is Chavez at home? Hard economic times and repressive policies have worn at his appeal as a socialist liberator of the poor. The global recession of the past 2 years hit Venezuela particularly hard. The country relies on oil for 90% of its export earnings and nearly one-third of its gross domestic product, so the effects are severe when demand and prices drop. With Chavez's nationalization of oil companies chilling foreign and corporate investment, Venezuela's economy has stagnated in recent years, and inflation has soared above 25%. A brutal currency devaluation last year drastically undercut spending power for imported goods. These events stirred public anger, as did reports of growing wealth among Chavez's family members. In September, Chavez suffered a serious blow when his opposition won about half of the popular vote in legislative elections and secured nearly 40% of the seats in the National Assembly. The vote, said one opposition leader, marked the beginning of the end for President Chavez. Is he truly in danger of being toppled? The risk is growing, but he's using everything at his disposal to tighten his grip. Venezuela's light-skinned elite generally loathes Chavez, who is a pardo, a darker-skinned Venezuelan from a poor family. But his expansion of literacy and health care among the poor, funded in part by intermittent nationalization of companies and expropriation of some opponents' property, have won him a loyal following. Throughout his public career, Chavez has demonstrated an uncanny capacity for survival. Overthrown in a coup in 2002, he reclaimed the presidency just 2 days later. He beat back a recall election in 2004. In 2009, he won a referendum to abolish presidential term limits, enabling him to run for office yet again in 2013. When his current term expires in recent months, Chavez has centralized power and cracked down on independent media. before the new assembly with his diminished majority convened this month, he used the lame duck assembly to place new curbs on dissent and grant himself expanded powers. And when times get tough, Chavez has his perpetual foil, the United States. Why is Chavez so anti-American? Poverty on the continent has long been blamed on American imperialism and on American support for oligarchs in the region. After joining the Venezuelan military as a young man, Chavez gradually developed a radical stance toward Venezuelan society's vast inequities. In 1992, he led a coup against the government, with rebel soldiers seizing installations throughout the country. But the bulk of the army remained loyal to the government, forcing Chavez to surrender. Chavez delivered a brief televised message that the revolution was aborted for now. That phrase, por ahora, became a rallying cry for poor and disaffected Venezuelans and sealed Chavez's identity as a revolutionary who would challenge the wealthy and the U.S. Does that antipathy remain? It may be stronger than ever. After Barack Obama was elected in 2008, Chavez said Venezuela was ready to begin a process of rapprochement with the new president, whom he called the black man. But the thaw was short-lived as the Obama administration spoke candidly about its objections to Chavez's policies. Larry Palmer, President Obama's choice for U.S. ambassador to Venezuela, told the U.S. Senate that there were clear ties between members of the Venezuelan government and Colombian guerrillas. Chavez immediately rejected Palmer as ambassador soon after the U.S. ejected Venezuela's ambassador in Washington. U.S. policy, Chavez said, has changed for the worst under Obama. The White House, meanwhile, has grown increasingly alarmed by Venezuela's outreach to stated enemies of the U.S. Who are Chavez's international allies? Chavez has long emulated the anti-American defiance of Cuban leader Fidel Castro, and he enjoys influence among other Latin American leftist leaders, including Bolivia's Evo Morales and Nicaragua's Daniel Ortega. He once called former Mexican President Vicente Fox a lapdog of empire, a stinging epithet in a region sensitive to American hegemony. Leaders in the region live in fear of Chavez turning against them, said a U.S. State Department official, because they worry that their people might not take their side. But Chavez has cultivated ties across the globe, often with regimes that are far more hostile to the U.S. than any in Latin America. Chavez has called Zimbabwean tyrant Robert Mugabe a freedom fighter. And on a state visit to Tehran last year, he declared Venezuela's unwavering allegiance to Iran. Chavez has negotiated energy deals with China and has enlisted Russian help in building a nuclear power plant in Venezuela. He's also been buying arms abroad, ostensibly to defend Venezuela from U.S. aggression. Is he a genuine threat? There is little fear that Chavez will lead the Venezuelan army in an attack on Texas. But despite the U.S., Chavez is undermining efforts to isolate Iran and may even give terrorists and spies a means to enter the Americas so that they can cross the U.S. border. Chavez dreams of going down in history as another Simon Bolivar, the South American liberator who led the rebellion against Spain. He thus looks for every opportunity to challenge the U.S. If imperialism ever has the idea of challenging Venezuela, he once declared, the aggressor will have to deal with Bolivar's people. And the footnote to this item in the week this week is entitled, Iran's Man in Caracas. Last October, Chavez made his ninth visit to Tehran, strengthening relations with a regime the U.S. considers a deadly menace. Weekly Iran Air flights from Tehran to Caracas began in 2007, and the U.S. State Department reported that officials in Caracas often failed to stamp the passports of the arriving passengers or enter them into an immigration database, suggesting they have high-level clearance. Venezuela has a number of oil production and shipment deals with Iran, and a proliferation of Iranian banks and factories in Venezuela has intensified suspicions that Chavez may be helping Iran elude international sanctions. Israel has questioned whether an air defense system Venezuela is buying from Russia is actually intended to defend Iran instead. Chavez's public comments only fueled the speculation. "We will stand by Iran no matter what," he said last fall. You're listening to a reading of The Week magazine, dated January 28, 2011. Thanks for joining us. Now we're going to turn to the health and science section. The first item here is entitled, "A Dense World Far, Far Away." Astronomers have detected the first rocky planet ever found outside our solar system. Until now, most of the some 500 exoplanets discovered orbiting distant stars have been Jupiter-sized gas giants. The latest find, named Kepler-10b, is only 40% larger than Earth, making it the smallest exoplanet yet identified, says the New York Times. The discovery is a significant milestone in search of planets similar to our own, says Douglas Hudgens, a scientist with NASA's Kepler satellite, which detected the body orbiting a star 560 light-years away. Kepler's instruments could discern the fractional reduction in the star's brightness as the planet crossed in front of it every 20 hours. Despite its geological kinship to the Earth, Kepler-10b is uninhabitable. It is 20 times closer to its star than Mercury is to the Sun and has a surface temperature hotter than lava. "She's a scorched world," says study director Natalie Batala. It was the hottest year for planet Earth. Last year tied with 2005 as the Earth's warmest on record, scientists at the National Climatic Data Center announced last week. They found that 2010 temperatures as recorded on land, ships, and ocean buoys averaged 1.12 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average of 57 degrees. Since comparable records began being kept in 1880, 9 of the 10 hottest years have occurred since 2000. The latest finding reinforces the notion that we are seeing climate change, the center's chief scientist, David Easterling, tells USA Today. Illustrating the difference between climate and weather, the announcement came on a day when 49 of the 50 U.S. states had some snow on the ground, according to the National Weather Service. The science of musical arousal. Listening to music may not be as fun as having sex, but it triggers the brain pleasure-inducing chemicals in the brain, or the same pleasure-inducing chemicals in the brain. Neuroscientists at McGill University scanned the brains of volunteers as they listened to their favorite instrumental music, ranging from punk to Beethoven to bagpipes. The scans reveal that as a particularly thrilling moment of music approached, the part of the brain's striatum region that's involved in anticipation and prediction released the neurochemical dopamine, the same chemical that gives rise to pleasurable feelings associated with eating, sex, and psychoactive drugs. When the musical climax arrived, dopamine surged through a different part of the striatum. The study recruited only volunteers who claimed to get chills from certain musical passages, but researchers say the dopamine response is probably common to all listeners. Previous research has hinted at a link between dopamine and musical enjoyment, notes Harvard neurologist Gottfried Schlag, who was not involved in the new finding, but the McGill study really nails it. Anxiety, banish the thought. So many Americans suffer from anxiety and depression that antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft have become household terms. But new research suggests that mindfulness therapy, a meditation-based treatment with roots in Buddhism and yoga, can help people with mood disorders feel better without drugs. "I was skeptical at first," Stefan Hoffman, a psychology professor at Boston University, tells the Los Angeles Times. "I wondered why on earth this should work. Yet after reviewing 39 studies on the practice involving 1,140 patients, Hoffman's team concluded that mindfulness therapy released anxiety and improved mood. Another study published last month found the treatment is as effective as antidepressants at preventing relapses of depression. It doesn't work for everyone, but experts have found that training patients to observe their own immediate thoughts can often loosen the grip emotions have on their minds. MRI scans of patients' brains display shifts in mental activity. Jordan Elliott, a 26-year-old marketer, began mindfulness therapy for debilitating anxiety 4 years ago. He now meditates for 10 minutes each morning and has stopped taking Prozac. When a negative thought pops off in my head, he says, I say to myself, there's a thought, and feelings aren't facts. The oldest vintage. Archaeologists working in Armenia have unearthed the oldest wine production facility ever found. Science Daily reports that 6,100-year-old site, located in the same cave complex where researchers found a 55-year-old moccasin last year, included a wine press, a clay vat for fermentation, a cup, storage jars, and withered vines. The discovery is 1,000 years older than the earliest comparable collection of winemaking remains found in Egypt in the 1980s. Among the Armenian finds is a shallow 3-foot-wide basin where people likely were stomping the grapes with their feet, just the way it was done all over the Mediterranean and the way it was originally done in California, says study co-director Gregory Arishian, an archaeologist at UCLA. The team also found seeds of the same domesticated grape subspecies, Vitis vinifera, used to make wine today. Dozens of graves near the site led researchers to suspect that the beverage was reserved for ceremonies, says Arishian. This wine wasn't used to unwind at the end of the day. And finally, from the Health and Science section, Healthcare of the Week, Kids and Secondhand Smoke. Children living with a parent who smokes are more likely to develop high blood pressure, researchers in Switzerland found, after analyzing medical data on 4,200 5- and 6-year-old children. They concluded that kids who live with smokers are 21% more likely to have dangerously high blood pressure. The problem often persists into adulthood and is the prime risk factor for heart disease, the researchers note. Prevention begins during childhood. Pediatrician and study author Giacomo Simonetti tells the USA Today, so do not smoke because it is not healthy for you and for your children. Smoking increases your and your children's blood pressure. Some 46,000 non-smoking Americans die each year due to heart disease brought on by living with secondhand smoke. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's take a look at the article entitled The Last Word. This one is specifically titled, Your Immortal Cyber Soul. The self you create online, says Rob Walker in the New York Times Magazine, won't die when you do. Suppose that just after you finish reading this article, you keel over dead. Perhaps you're ready for such an eventuality, in that you have prepared a will or made some sort of arrangement for the fate of the worldly goods you leave behind, financial assets, personal effects, belongings likely to have sentimental value to others, and artifacts of your life, photographs, journals, letters. Even if you haven't made such arrangements, all of this will get sorted out one way or another, maybe in line with what you have wanted, and maybe not. But many of us, in these worst of circumstances, would also leave behind things that exist outside of those familiar categories. Suppose you blogged or tweeted about this article, or dashed off a Facebook status update, or uploaded a few snapshots from your iPhone to Flickr, and then logged off this mortal coil. It's now taken for granted that the things we do online are reflections of who we are or announcements of who we wish to be. So what happens to this version of you that you've built with bits? Who will have access to which parts of it, and for how long? For most of us, the fate of tweets and status updates and the like may seem trivial. Who cares? I'll be dead. But increasingly, we're not leaving a record of life by culling and stowing away physical journals or shoeboxes of letters and photographs for heirs or the future. Instead, we are collectively busy producing fresh masses of life-affirming digital stuff. 5 billion images and counting on Flickr, hundreds of thousands of YouTube videos uploaded every day, oceans of content from 20 million bloggers and 500 million Facebook members, 2 billion tweets a month. Sites and services warehouse our musical and visual creations, personal data, shared opinions, and taste declarations in the form of reviews and lists and ratings, even virtual scrapbook pages. Avatars left behind in World of Warcraft or Second Life can have a financial or intellectual property holdings in those alternate realities. One estimate pegs the number of U.S. Facebook users who die annually at something like 375,000. Academics have begun to explore the subject: how does this change the way we remember and grieve? Social media consultants have begun to talk about it. What are the legal implications? And entrepreneurs are trying to build whole new businesses around digital afterlife management. Is there a profit opportunity? Evan Carroll and John Romano, interaction design experts in Raleigh, North Carolina, who run a site called thedigitalbeyond.com, have just published a tips and planning book, Your Digital Afterlife, with advice about such matters as appointing a digital executor. On October 18, 2009, Mac Tonnies updated his blog, sent out some public tweets and private messages via Twitter, went to bed, and died of cardiac arrhythmia. While he had experienced some symptoms that indicated potential heart problems, his sudden death came as a shock even to those who knew him well. He was only 34. Tonnies lived in Kansas City, Missouri. He was single and childless, owned two cats, and paid his bills through workday jobs, behind the counter at Starbucks or doing phone work for a small marketing agency. He was also a writer. He had just finished a draft of his third book with an adventurous intellect. His audience was small but devoted. Tonnies, who started his blog Posthumous Blues in 2003, was an extremely active user of online media and forged many friendships with people he never met in the physical world. Many of his interests were distinctly future-oriented, a freewheeling consideration of the very nature of humanity. Rita J. King, an expert on online identity and persona, who is an innovator in residence for IBM, was introduced to Tonnies via email in 2004, and they kept in frequent touch. "He is the one I had all my conversations with early on about technology and consciousness," she says. The last entry on Posthuman Blues was titled Triptych Number 15, a set of three images with no text. The first comment to this post came from an anonymous reader wondering why Tonnies had not updated the blog or tweeted for 2 days. Some similar comments followed, and then this: "Mac Tonnies passed away earlier in the week. Our condolences are with his family and friends in this time of grief." The author of that comment was also anonymous. After a rapid back and forth about whether this startling news was true and some details of the circumstances, that post's comment section transformed into a remarkable mix of tributes, grieving, and commiseration. You can still read all this today in a thread that runs to more than 250 comments. "It was a very strange feeling," Dana Tonnies, Mac's mother, told me, describing how she and her husband became aware of the swirl of activity attached to her son's online self. "I had no control over what was being said about him almost immediately. Dana and Bob Tonnies were close to their only son. In fact, they had coffee with him in a regular Sunday ritual the morning before he died, but they had little contact with his digital self." Dana is presently going through Posthuman Blues in order from the beginning. "I still have a year to go," she says. "Reading it has been amazing," she continues. "Funny posts, personal posts, poetic posts, angry posts about the state of the world. I asked her if what she is reading seems like a different or specifically narrow version of her son. "Oh, no, it's him," she says. "I can hear him when I read it." I spoke to a half dozen people MacTonnies met online and in some cases never encountered in the physical world. Each expressed a genuine sense of loss. A few sounded grief-stricken even more than a year later. Mark Plattner, who lives in St. Louis and met Tonnies a dozen years ago through the comments section of another blog, decided that post-human blues needed to survive. He used software called SightSucker to put a backup of the entire thing, pictures, videos, links included, on a hard drive. In all, Plattner has about 10 gigabytes of material offering a sense of Tonnies' personality and who he was. Plattner says, "That's what we want to remember." This outpouring of digital grief, memorial-making, documentation, and self-expression is unusual, maybe unique for now because of the kind of person Tonnies was and the kinds of friends he made online. But maybe, his friend Rita King suggests, his story is also a kind of early signal of one way that digital afterlives might play out. And she doesn't just mean this in an abstract way, scholarly way. "I find solace," she told me, "in going to Mac's Twitter feed. Survivors may not be aware of the deceased's full digital hoard, or they may not have the passwords to access the caches they do know about. They may be uncertain to the point of inaction about how to approach this problem at all. This has inspired a variety of entrepreneurs to place bets that eventually people will want control over the afterlife of their digital selves. Several promise to manage the details of your digital death, storing your passwords and your wishes for who gets access to what, and integrating your content-related instructions into a kind of adjunct to a traditional will. Legacy Locker claims around 10,000 people have signed up for its digital estate management service already. My favorite digital morality business, DeathSwitch.com, gives the idea of speaking from beyond the grave a web-era update. DeathSwitch was founded in 2006 by the neuroscientist and writer David Eagleman to coincide with a short story he wrote for Nature titled A Brief History of Death Switches. The story imagines an automated service that allowed its users to send messages after they die. People use it to reveal secret bank accounts to heirs, confess to sins, or settle scores from beyond the grave. Over time, uses for this fictional death switch become so elaborate that it is hard to tell that the sender of the message is deceased. That last part hasn't happened yet, but otherwise the service offered by DeathSwitch.com in real life is basically the same as the fictional one, some final words from you to whomever after you've gone. Mac Tonney's many eclectic intellectual pursuits included at least a passing interest in the notion of cyber immortality. The idea of the self escaping bodily death by transforming into an age-proof, sickness-proof essence that can be uploaded into a computer or network dates back to at least to Werner Vinge's 1981 novella True Names. A year after that, William Gibson gave us the word cyberspace to describe a new place where humans might exist, potentially forever, outside of the physical world. By the 1990s, as the Internet became a familiar presence in many people's lives, some began to suggest that it was no mere science fiction scenario. It was the future. Vinge was among those, along with notable Ray Kurzweil, to discuss the transformation of humans by technology, coming in a matter of decades, referred to as the singularity. The Carnegie Mellon robotics expert Hans Moravec, the artificial intelligence pioneer Marvin Minsky, the computer scientist Rudy Rucker, and others articulated visions of a future in which technology might truly free us from the bloody mess of organic matter, to use a phrase of Minsky's. In her 1999 book, The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, Margaret Wertheim contextualized such speculations as attempts to, in effect, construct a technological substitute for the Christian space of heaven. Wertheim pointed out that cyberspace had become a new kind of place where alternate or at least carefully curated or burnished identities could be forged outside the familiar boundaries of the physical world, like the body and geography. It's not such a long journey to follow those assertions to the view that man is defined not by the atoms of his body, but by an information code, as Wertheim wrote. This is the belief that our essence lies not in our matter, but in a pattern of data. She called this idea the cyber soul, a posited immortal self, this thing that can supposedly live on in the digital domain after our bodies die. I found myself wondering about what MacTonnie's take on all this might be. The last of his friends to whom I spoke was Paul Kimball, a filmmaker who lives in Nova Scotia. He met Tonnies online about a decade ago. Among their shared interests, it turns out, was the relationship among technology, consciousness, and mortality. The day before we spoke, Kimball continued, he had linked to an old post-human blues post on his Facebook page, seeking reactions from his own online circle. So I'm still having this conversation with Tonnies, he told me, even though he's been dead for more than a year. Eventually, Kimball added, such situations may be routine. We're entering a world where we can all leave as much of a legacy as George Bush or Bill Clinton. Maybe that's the ultimate democratization, he said. It gives all of us a chance at immortality. After talking to Kimball, I ended up watching a couple of interview clips of Tonnies on the YouTube. I like to think of death as a glorified terminal illness, MacTonnie said, and will continue to say for as long as this particular collection of bits remain available for someone to watch and listen to. If he can escape the boundaries of death, Tonnies says, well, maybe that will be okay. This article was written by Rob Walker. He is the author of Buying In, and the story was originally published and appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Now let's take a look at a few items of interest from Talking Points, a section in the Week magazine, the first one entitled Palin, the Price of Pugnacity. If Sarah Palin ever had any chance of becoming president, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times, it's now over. After a madman's recent shooting spree in Tucson, Palin found herself once again at the center of controversy, and rather than rise to the occasion, she succumbed to bitter partisanship and rancor. Liberal pundits had strongly criticized Palin for putting a gun's crosshairs on Representative Gabrielle Giffords' district this fall, suggesting that she had created a climate that led to the shooting. In response, a defensive Palin said it was the left that was fomenting violence and accused her critics of a blood libel, a term usually reserved for the monstrous charge that Jews drank Christian babies' blood. Her loyal fans undoubtedly loved Palin's pugnacity, but moderate Republicans and independents want confident leaders with stature who can show grace under pressure. Palin should have kept her mouth shut during this very sensitive time, said Deborah Saunders in the San Francisco Chronicle, but she's addicted to attention. It's not Palin's fault that she was dragged into the controversy, said Catherine Jean Lopez in National Review Online. Given the promiscuous use of her name in 4 days of news coverage, she had to defend herself from the scurrilous attempt to blame her for Giffords' shooting. When she answered unfair criticism with confrontation, said Patrick Johnson in the Christian Science Monitor, Palin was simply being consistent. Her campaign motto last fall, don't retreat, reload, was not a call to violence, but her way of urging fellow conservatives to stand up to the criticism and scorn of the media and blue state elites. Palin's critics may find that kind of strength and courage divisive, but to backers, it sets her apart. The next item entitled Wikipedia, a decade of amateur expertise. Wikipedia was launched just 10 years ago, yet already it's hard to imagine what life was like before it arrived, said Todd Wasserman in Mashable.com. When co-founders Jimmy Wales and Larry Sanger invited thousands of unpaid amateurs to create and edit a free online encyclopedia, they had no idea what they were unleashing. This worldwide web of 35,000 volunteers has come a remarkably long way since then, said Timothy Garton Ash in the Los Angeles Times. Wikipedia now has 17 million articles in 270 languages, some 400 million users consulted every month, and it usually pops up among the top 10 results in the Google search. As a commercial venture, Wikipedia could be worth billions, yet it remains a nonprofit that breathes the utopian idealism of the Internet's early days. Just don't count on it being accurate, said Lance Ulanoff in PCMagazine.com. The fact that so many people have access to its entries makes it ripe for error, deliberate falsehoods, and unstated agendas. The site's entry on Microsoft, for example, makes the company sound oddly sinister, whereas the one on Apple provides no hints of monopolistic practices. Are such judgments the role of an encyclopedia? My own page was edited to state that I'd served in the French Foreign Legion and dated supermodels. Funny, but 100% false. The writing is awful, too, said Jonathan Lethem in TheAtlantic.com. With its institutional-sounding, grindingly monotonous prose, Wikipedia has narrowed the vibrant chaos of the Internet just as badly as Facebook and Google. Yet we're all supposed to bow in gratitude to this noble volunteer army, while it subjects us to death by pedantry. You clearly don't grasp what you're seeing, said James Bridle, also in TheAtlantic.com. Click on the View History button at the top of the Wikipedia article on the Iraq War, for example, and you'll see that it's been edited 12,000 times. Printed out, that would be a 12-volume encyclopedia of shifting perspectives. This is what culture actually looks like, a gradual and cacophonous process of argument, dissent, and accreting opinion. And that points to Wikipedia's central miracle, said Clay Shirky in the London Guardian. It works by putting the people who care in charge, and it gets better every day, because someone decided to make it better. In a world run by greed, idiots, and paid liars, Wikipedia remains one of the largest cumulative acts of generosity in history. Tiger Mother, are we pampering our kids? Welcome to the Mommy Wars, Panzer Division, said Judith Warner in the New York Times Magazine. Amy Chua's new memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, has triggered a passionate debate about proper parenting by laying out the case for raising your kids with an iron hand. Chua, a super-achieving Yale Law School professor herself, demands that her daughters get an A in every class and spend hours on homework every day and additional hours practicing piano and violin. She forbids, as a waste of valuable time, sleepovers, playdates, school plays, and extracurricular activities. Don't even mention TV, Chua's mothering toolbox is shocking, said Patricia Wen in the Boston Globe. She yells and screams to get compliance and calls her kids garbage if they show her disrespect. She even threatens to burn the children's stuffed animals. It may sound draconian, but it works. Her teen girls are standouts academically and musically, with her oldest girl already giving one performance in Carnegie Hall. If it takes demented drive to get your kid to Carnegie Hall, said Hannah Rosen in the Wall Street Journal, count me out. In pretty much every way, I am the weak-willed, pathetic Western parent that Chua describes. My goal is to raise happy children who will discover and pursue their own passions, not perfect little proto-adults fulfilling parenting expectations. In the book, Chua admits, the truth is I'm not good at enjoying life. Is she teaching her kids to be similarly joyless? It's worth noting that Asian Americans have the highest suicide rate among women ages 15 to 24, said Aled Waldman, also in the Wall Street Journal. Is it possible that that, too, is a product of Chinese child-rearing techniques of shrieking and name-calling? And we'll conclude this week with a couple of items from Poll Watch. After his speech on the Tucson shootings last week, President Obama's approval rating surged to 54%, an 8-point jump from September, and the highest it's been since April 2010. 78% of those polled approved of Obama's handling of the tragedy. And 31% of Americans who have combined their finances with their spouses say they have lied to their partners about money. 58% of the admitted liars say they hid cash, 15% hid a secret bank account, 11% lied about their debts, and 11% lied about how much money they really earn. Well, we have run out of time for today's reading of this week's The Week magazine. Be sure to join me next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.